Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters, that's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretends she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Lindsay McCrae on the show with me today. Lindsay has a fantastic new book. It's called My Penguin Life, Life Among the Emperors. And let me tell you guys, this book is astounding. What an incredible story. And I'm so excited to talk with you today. Welcome to the show, Lindsay.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or a storyteller?
I think probably watching A Family of Badgers, which is how my career started, and wanting to tell people about what I'd seen. I think that was my first memory of that.
Wow. How old would you have been then?
Probably 9 or 10. I just remember seeing whatever I saw in front of me was so amazing. I was desperate to tell people about it.
What sort of impact did that have on you? Did that open your eyes to a whole new, you know, aspect of life and the world? What was it that, that excited you the most?
I don't know, really. I mean, I was so young and I've had this passion for so long now. I just loved spending every minute of every day outside. I was really, and still am, you know, so into the natural world. And it's my get out of jail card, if you like, if I'm having a rough time at home or, you know, in the city. Just getting outside and getting amongst the natural world is my switch off button. And I see such amazing stuff that, I want to tell people about it.
You've worked as a wildlife photographer and cameraman for quite some time. How did you start steering in that direction career-wise?
Well, I always wanted to work with wildlife. It wasn't until I was sort of my early teens that I got any experience with a camera. I wrote to the BBC wanting them to come and film in my area. And they actually came and made a small film about me, because this was probably 16, 17 years ago now. And for a young boy that long ago, it was kind of a funky thing to do. None of my mates were into bird watching or watching wildlife, so it was quite unusual. The BBC made the small film. They lent me a small camera, and I very quickly realized the opportunities this piece of kit gave me. And then I realized that maybe I could work with wildlife and cameras and film it for a living. And you never, ever think that you're going to reach, you know, that's actually going to become your career, or I certainly never did. But fortunately, I left school, I'd made a few contacts, and the BBC offered me a job. And all I was doing was making cups of tea and doing the shopping, but it was meeting more people. That's the way I got in, really.
Well, making cups of tea in the place where stuff happens, sometimes it's just that's all a kid needs, you know, to be near where stuff happens can be contagious.
Yeah, that first foot in the door is usually the hardest. But once you've conquered that step, things happen quickly. And certainly that was the case with me.
Right. Well, some people bird watch or take wildlife photography as a hobby, and it's just for their personal satisfaction, for their personal enlightenment. But it's another thing to seek out things that you then want to share with the world. What is it about the education aspect of it, the enlightenment aspect,
that makes you want to take what you see and bring more people into your world?
Well, I was lucky because I've grown up knowing how amazing our natural world is and how important it is. And a lot of youngsters lose that very early on. And why, I'm not quite sure, whether adults just don't quite drill it into them and that's how they lose it. But I'm just fully aware of how important, how good it is for mental health as well. If, you know, if I'm stressed, it's where I go and it's where I'm easily just back down to earth. And I think it's important that people know that and are aware of how easy it is just to get the headspace and think. And you know, it doesn't have to be, life doesn't have to be 100 mile an hour all the time. I just think the more I can tell people about how amazing the natural world is, then maybe, you know, the ones who aren't so interested give it a go and realize how cool it is.
So you go from making tea and running errands at the BBC. How does that transition into more of what you were seeking?
Well, it was being in touch with the right people and being around them and managing to show them that I meant business and I knew what I was on about and I was keen. The program I was actually working on, my working hours would be from 8 a.m. until about 10 p.m. They were long days. So the only spare time I had was before 8 a.m. But obviously that's a great time for wildlife. So I'd go in early and go walk about and find stuff. And then I'd ring the producers or the cameraman. Hey, cool. Look what I found. Come and film it. So very quickly I was contributing more than I think they were expecting. So after that, I was given camera assisting roles, where I could get my hands on actual camera equipment. And I always knew the ins and outs of the wildlife. That's how I got to where I am. Really. I didn't really know the ins and outs of camera kit. So being able to get my hands on professional gear was all I really needed. It was these people that I'd met through making cups of tea for them that gave me these opportunities.
Your book, My Penguin Year, Life Among the Emperors, is this grand adventure that you went on for the better part of a year, studying the emperor penguins in Antarctica, of all places. You probably don't go from just a workaday visual journalist to an epic adventure like that. How did you start venturing out to more and more adventurous subjects that eventually led to this?
It's funny. Very quickly, work started coming to me that was abroad, and I'd be camera assisting and then I was given opportunities. And by the time I was offered Antarctica, I had actually been filming wildlife for the BBC and other independent companies for 8 years. So a decent amount of time. So a lot of people knew me at this point. And I think for a lot of wildlife camera people, going to Antarctica and filming emperors is top of their list. And certainly had been top of mind for as long as I can remember, but you never expect it to be offered. These trips are few and far between. And when they do come, you don't expect them to come to you. You expect somebody else to get asked. So when I was given this opportunity, it was simply one I just couldn't turn down.
What was your first experience with the emperor penguins? How did this, you talk about this kind of being the pinnacle of what people aspire to. How did you learn about them and what really piqued your interest?
Well, bizarrely enough, it was all the sort of bad aspects of the trip that excited me. So I'd be the furthest away from home I probably ever could be. I'd be working in the hardest conditions I'd ever experience. But the payoff would be filming a creature which so few people get to see. Everybody knows what an emperor penguin looks like. Their life cycle is relatively well known, but actually seeing one in the wild, so few people get, even tourists, so few tourists get the opportunity to actually see them. So I just knew this was such a rare opportunity. In fact, you could probably count on two hands the amount of people that have spent an entire year just watching Emperors. That was the aim of their year. So I know how lucky I've been.
When you decided to take on this project, this meant not only being away from work for a year, but this was a big decision for your personal life as well. You were newly married. Tell me about how did this opportunity come about, and what were some of the personal stakes that you had in it?
Yeah, well, although it was a dream of mine, I didn't really know what it involved and what sacrifices I'd have to make. I suppose I was a bit naive in that respect. But yeah, at that point, I had a girlfriend, we had two dogs, we'd bought a house. And I'd actually met Becky, my wife. We got married just before I left, but we'd met in television. And she remembers vividly one of the first things I ever said to her. She asked me, what do you most want to film? And I said, well, Emperors in Antarctica. So she knew deep down that she couldn't stop me from going. But still, I remember that I actually knew 2 years in advance of going that I was going. There was a lot of preparation involved. So there was a long lead up time. And the couple of months before I actually left, I had huge second thoughts. I really thought mentally, I didn't think I could cope. I thought, there was a long period throughout my 11-month trip where I wouldn't be able to get home. And that's one of the reasons it was so long is there's a period of isolation where the weather just prevents anybody from coming in and anybody from leaving. And I did think, maybe I'm not actually ready for this. It's quite a big undertaking. And I almost threw the towel in, but fortunately I went ahead with it. And it's what's quite good about this book is I've been able to talk about sacrifices which people don't necessarily know. They watch the final program and they'd see a little bit about how it was made, but obviously I've got family at home that make enormous sacrifices too. So it was nice to go behind the scenes.
So you said that there's like a 2 year preparation time of all of the things to get in line to make a trip like this. What was the plan, the work plan, if you will? Did you have a schedule of when we land, this is going to happen? What were some of the accomplishments that you had laid out that you wanted to make sure happened while you were there?
Well, filming wise, so for the actual film, basically we wanted to cover every aspect of the Emperor Penguin's life cycle. And That is quite well known. It's a story that's been told many times. So we wanted to try and do it differently. So we had the emperors returning after their summer at sea, feeding. That was on our list. We obviously had mating, laying their eggs hatching, all the classic stuff which goes into reproducing that next generation. But this series was different because it was focusing on that one individual family or group. And what we were relying on were things happening while we were there to bring our film to life. And we managed to capture some pretty unusual events that ended up being key parts of the film. And that's what made it at the end of the day. But that was purely because we were given such a huge amount of time to focus on the colony and capture these bits of behavior that we didn't expect.
How do you prepare for a trip like that? You're living and working in England. This is a part of the world that very few of us will ever get to visit, much less spend a prolonged amount of time. And there's really no dress rehearsal for that, without being there. It's one of those things that it's very difficult to duplicate for any amount of time. How do you prepare for the conditions and for, how you're going to adapt to day-to-day life in such a harsh climate?
Yeah, well, preparing to be in a harsh climate, there was nothing we could do really other than wait and see what it was like. But we, being isolated put a whole new spin on things because we wouldn't be able to get help if we needed it. We were relying on each other, our team members. But that meant being completely self-sufficient, a lot of us. So we did a lot of training up on a glacier in Austria, in the middle of Europe. where there are big crevasses in the ice, and we learned how to pull ourselves out and rescue our teammates in case that happened. We actually did an intense firefighter training course, believe it or not, because if the station we were living in set alight, we would be the ones that would have to put that fire out. So we had to learn how to do that. And obviously medically, I was examined so thoroughly because they didn't want to be sending down somebody who would then maybe get ill and they'd have to evacuate me, because evacuation was possible, but it's easier to rescue somebody from the International Space Station that is in an Antarctic winter. So we just had to accept that that was pretty impossible. So they obviously wanted to make sure that we were fit and healthy enough to travel in the first place. And kit wise, yeah, we actually put cameras into a freezer room in the south of the UK and dropped the temperature to minus 40 and made sure that they worked. But yeah, nothing could really prepare us until we actually got down there and got to work. So yeah, it's funny. A lot of people ask me, oh, what's it going to be like? And I just had to answer, I've no idea. I'll tell you when I get back.
Oh, man. How much footage did you shoot while you were there?
Well, time-wise, I probably can't tell you. I don't know. But size-wise, so the unusual thing about this trip was back when Planet Earth, the first BBC series, had gone down there and overwintered, everything was shot on film. So not only could they not review it, they had to wait until they got back to the UK before it was developed, before they could even see if their cameras had actually worked. Whereas when we went down, we had there's been such an advance in technology with regards to camera kit, and the station had good internet, so we were able to review clips, offload them, put them on hard drives, and actually send low resolution footage back to our producers in the UK for them to review. So size wise, I think we took about 120 terabytes worth of
wow.
storage. We didn't fill that. I'm not sure how close we got, but yeah, it was pretty mega.
Yeah. What was when you landed, and you know, kind of the reality of, you know, the adventure that we're on and the commitment that we've made. What was that emotionally like? You know, once you're there and you kind of cross the point of no return. You know, does the anticipation of this thing that you've looked forward to, is that enough to carry you through? You know, what do you do when things get lonely and stark?
Yeah. Well, I found the whole thing quite emotional, just not because I was struggling with being away from home. I mean, I was at certain points, but just the enormity of what I was witnessing. I just knew how special everything was that we were seeing. I remember when we first landed, and I'd actually had a tough week because I'd left home. I'd left Becky, my wife, on the doorstep in tears, and we knew that we wouldn't see each other for the next year. And all I wanted to do was get there and get on with the job and get busy. And we'd had a week in Cape Town waiting for the weather in Antarctica to settle before we could actually fly. And that week was quite a long week, just waiting for that plane to come and pick us up. But once we landed and we saw our first penguins, it was game on. From then on, that was really when the adventure started. And yeah, from then on, we were just seeing amazing stuff every day.
So when you land, how long does it take you to catch up with the group of penguins? And, you know, what did they think of you being there?
Well, we turned up on the longest day in the Southern Hemisphere, the 21st of December, just before Christmas. And what we expected to land to was Atka Bay, which is where our penguins breed on the sea ice, on the frozen ocean. The previous years before we'd gone down there, this sea ice had remained solid even throughout the summer. It hadn't broken up. So the penguins had always been there. They'd been coming and going from the ocean feeding. Anyway, when we turn up, that whole bay broke up and it was all open ocean all of a sudden, and the penguins went with it. So we saw a few penguins to start with, but it was a case then of waiting for the sea to refreeze, for that solid platform which they would breed on to reform, and then they would return having fed for the summer. So it was a strange week to start with, because we had all these penguins to film, and then all of a sudden we had nothing, and it was a case of waiting, well, 3 or 4 months really for the sea to refreeze. And yeah, it was, that was a bit of a shock and something we weren't expecting, but it made the day that they did return even more special.
Oh, sure. That had to be disheartening, at least in the beginning. You know, we did all this to come, and now, you know, it's sit and wait. What did you do to occupy your time?
Yeah, it was very frustrating as well, and I was questioning, why have we come to this place? You know, the Penguins have gone, got nothing to film. And however, having said that, the wildlife which an open ocean offered was incredible. So we were seeing orcas, killer whales every day. We were seeing minke whales every day. And these are whales that wouldn't have been able to feed in this part of Antarctica because they wouldn't have been able to breathe with a layer of ice that thick. So with this ice breaking up, it opened up all these new opportunities. We were seeing snow petrels, Antarctic petrels, giant petrels, Weddell seals, leopard seals. It was just fantastic. And only because the sea ice had broken up. So although the penguins had gone, and we did see the odd penguin drift by on an ice floe, but with it breaking up, it did have its advantages.
What do you think the penguins thought of you and your small crew that were there? Were they scared of you guys, or did they accept you into their group?
Yeah, I accepted us, and even more. I think a lot of them had probably never seen a human being before, so they've got no reason to be scared down there. Just to give you an idea of size, if I knelt down, one would look me in the eye. They're big, big birds. We obviously had certain rules to stick to. We weren't allowed to approach super close. There were a certain amount of meters we had to keep away. But you'd set the camera up every day, and you'd turn around, and there'd be four penguins lying asleep next to you. They absolutely loved our company, and they were so inquisitive. That was lovely.
Were there certain rules of engagement that you tried to follow? Other than the getting too close, were you ever in a situation where maybe you sensed harm might come to these penguins, and you had the ability to intervene in some way? Did that ever come up? And if so, how do you make those decisions about where, you know, what you should just allow to happen naturally that would have happened whether you would have been there or not? Or, you know, do you intervene and maybe alter the way these penguins behave?
Yeah, no, we had a big event, which ended up being quite a big part of the film in the end. In September, we'd been with the birds. We'd been in Antarctica, 8 or 9 months at this point. So we were very close to the colony as a whole. We'd been through almost everything that the birds had been through, the storms, just everything. So we were close to the birds. And yeah, we returned after a 2 week long storm, and a load of birds had been blown into deep ravines. And this was a unique situation because this time of the year in Antarctica, there is no other life. The emperors are the only ones to stay and breed through the winter. And it's part of their strategy. They do this because all their predators leave, so they have no predators there when they give birth to their chicks, or the chicks hatch and whatever. However, the weather is probably their big predator. And in this occasion, yeah, the weather had blown them into this ravine. And what we quickly worked out was the birds that still had chicks on their feet couldn't use their legs to their full range and climb up these steep walls of ice. So they're having to make a horrendous decision to leave their chicks at the bottom to die and save themselves, or they both perished down there. And we saw this on a couple of occasions, and it was simply something we couldn't walk away from, knowing we'd not done anything. So yeah, we dug them a shallow ramp, and fortunately they used it and saved themselves. So that was quite a nice feeling.
That's incredible. Was there ever a day where, it looked like, a tragedy was going to strike? And what was kind of one of your most harrowing days?
I think that the emperors are so well built for that place. They've evolved to withstand the most horrendous weather. Obviously, we haven't, but I was desperate to see them in action, see them battling against this weather. And they probably weren't in danger, because what we could film in was only half of what they really have to put up with. So It just becomes too unsafe for humans to be out on the ice with them. Visibility becomes zero. The wind speed, you can't even stand up. And obviously the temperature drops ridiculously. So yeah, what we filmed in was probably the worst we could cope with, but that was only half of what the birds really put up with. And yeah, we had a really bad storm one day, and we stayed with the birds and filmed as much as we possibly could, probably stayed a bit longer than we should have done because we still had to get back to our station while this weather deteriorated. And a 10-minute skidoo journey took us just under 3 hours. And we were simply relying on these tiny little GPSs, these little metal boxes on our handlebars. Our life was in their hands, and they directed us back to the station because you couldn't see the skidoo in front of you, even though you were tail to tail. It was, yeah, horrendous. And that was quite frightening, if I'm honest, because you sort of know so many safety measures are in place that you'll be okay, but it doesn't make it any easier when you're in those conditions. And you've got goggles on that are filling with snow. You've got ice blasting across your face, frostbite on your face. And you're leaning against the wind just to try and stay upright. And at the same time, trying to find the station and get back inside and warm up. So, yeah, that was quite a frightening day.
And we're getting to talk about this because when you got home, you started taking your experiences and, you know, recording those thoughts and putting them together. And that eventually led us to your book, My Penguin Year, Life Among the Emperors. What was the motivation to record your experiences and make a book out of it?
Well, I was well aware of how lucky I was being given this opportunity. And I know that a lot of people would love to see an emperor penguin. I know a lot of people would love to get to Antarctica, but it's so remote. It's so expensive. There's only certain times of the year you can actually get there. And I fully accept, even without this trip, I probably would have never got there. So I just thought this was the perfect opportunity to try and tell people what it's like down there and how amazing a place it is. And that we do still have these places left. You know, we're in a bit of a tough time with climate change and global warming, but there are still places out there which are worth protecting, and Antarctica is one of them.
What was Lindsay, when you got back home and you have a wife waiting for you, you have a brand new son whom you've never met before waiting for you, I can only imagine the attachment that you felt to Antarctica and to the penguins and this whole experience. You can't live there for the better part of a year and not, you know, feel some attachment and kinship almost to the place and to the wildlife and feeling like you've become a part of it. But then, of course, you have this strong pull and draw back home where you're from and with the people that love you. And that had to be a melancholy sort of leaving there and then the reentry back home. What was that experience like for you?
It was strange. I'd read some horror stories of people returning from isolation like I'd experienced. Obviously I'd only lived with 11 other people for 8 months. I'd not seen anybody else. I'd not seen a car. I'd not seen a tree. Life was very different down there and easy in some respects. Money doesn't exist. Time doesn't exist. There are no borders. So if you need help in the summer, especially, you know, another station will probably come and help you. And they're usually from a different nation. So it's a pretty amazing place. But obviously coming back, I was being thrown within hours back into reality and the hustle and bustle of normal life. But I think I was saved by my little boy, Walter, because I was thrown back into parenthood. And given a job to do, which kept me distracted, and I wasn't given much chance to think about the life I'd led for the previous year. And I think without Walter, I'd have struggled because I definitely missed Antarctica. And So I've got him to thank for keeping me busy.
When how long did it take you to kind of gather all of your thoughts and find a narrative thread for this story?
Probably a year after I got back. I'd I'd actually started writing down there. I thought, if I can keep up, maybe by the end of the trip, I'll have a book. But it simply just took too much time and I couldn't keep up. So, yeah, come February, I had to just put it to one side. But then, yeah, a year after I got back, I had a bit of time and I thought, you know, I'll give this a go. And yeah, very quickly, it started to take shape. And yeah, it's funny, really, because you sit down and you write, and you don't really know what you've got until you finish it and then go back through it. It was a process I enjoyed, and it was such an incredible year. All my memories were still so vivid in my mind, and obviously I had a film that we'd made that I could refer back to and remind me of a lot of those moments. So,
Did you ever worry while you're there in Antarctica because the hustle and bustle of life are absent there and you're fully present, fully invested in this in this trip and you know, being in this other place, that the days start running together and it's difficult to start setting markers, if you will, for days and weeks and months, you know, as you're going back over these experiences and memories, is it difficult to pull out, you know, when things happened and what the progression of time actually was?
Not really. What I did was tried to split it up, obviously chronologically, and around the the emperor's life cycle. So the first was obviously the birds returning from their summer out at sea feeding, and then that would lead on to the courtship process, and then just weaving my personal life and what I was experiencing throughout that period into those chapters. I remember the whole thing so vividly that I sort of know exactly when things happened, and that definitely made life easier when I started putting pen to paper and writing the book.
Sure. The book is also, filled throughout with these wonderful photos that you've included. What was one of your favorite photos that you got from this experience?
Oh, blimey. Usually I don't really get a chance to take any photographs because my job is to film the wildlife. But obviously this trip was a bit different because we had such huge amounts of time. My favorite photograph. I don't know. Maybe the one on the cover, if I'm honest. Those days, it's funny, the days that are crystal clear and you've got blue skies and a bright sun and white ice and then the birds and those days are beautiful, but it was actually the overcast days, like the one on the cover of the book, where everything was white, and the birds just stood out so vividly against that. It's funny, those overcast days, even though they weren't as pretty in pictures, they made for interesting shots. And probably the one on the cover.
This year where you followed the life cycle of the penguins and, you know, watched the, through the mating season and then the hatching and, you know, the little ones and how they're cared for, you leave that and go home to immediately be a new father. I'm betting that the irony there was not lost on you.
No. Yeah, it was strange. I'd not thought about this beforehand. How parallel my life was to an emperor's. I'd left Becky pregnant with our first boy, and just 4 months to go until he was born. And then, obviously, while I was in Antarctica, I watched the female emperors leave the males and leave them for 60 odd days, not knowing whether they'd return to a chick or not. So, yeah. It was strange, and obviously it was our first, I mean, one of the reasons we decided to do this and make our trip so complicated was because it was our first child. We didn't know what we were expecting. We didn't know what to expect. So we decided to go through this first parenthood experience and see what happened. And I think had I known what I'd be missing, it would have been a different story.
Well, what a fantastic story it is. My penguin year life among the emperors. Lindsay, this is such a fascinating book. I learned so much that I didn't know about the area and about the wildlife there, but you know, I also felt a certain kinship with you as I'm reading it, that that I felt like I was going on this adventure with you. I love the book. It's out, available everywhere now. We're going to put links to it in the show notes. There's also an audiobook, and did you narrate the audiobook?
Yes, I did, yeah.
What a fantastic experience that must have been.
Yeah. Yeah, very strange reading your own. It's the quickest I've ever read a book.
I love it. We're going to put links to it in the show notes. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me today. If people are just learning about you, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
There is. My social media details are in the book, but it's from when I was a young boy, and it's at BadgerBoy05. And that's on all the social media sites.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you. Lindsay, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
No use crying over spilled milk. Eliza hated that cliche. She'd grown up a cliche. Her life, a bowl of cherries, duck soup, easy as pie, child's play behind a white picket fence. Mother had been the Wyatt Earp of cliches, firing them off, quick draw. A rotten apple spoils the barrel. Smile and the world smiles with you. Every dog has his day. Children should be seen and not heard. She believed them all, particularly this last. Eliza obliged, preferring to wander the streets of Wytheville, Virginia, on her own lonesome terms. The divorce left Laura a spinster librarian, and one false step on icy stairs left her an invalid as well. The accident happened on New Year's Eve, 1950. Laura had just locked the doors of Wytheville Public Library. We must make black-eyed peas tomorrow, Laura had been thinking, with turnip greens. That ensured a lucky New Year, and if you swept some money over your threshold, a prosperous one, too. She loved those old Southern traditions. She looked both ways, checking for Negroes, but turned a heel on the icy marble of the stairs and fell into the bushes below, breaking the long bones in both legs. Eliza had taken advantage of her mother's absence. She'd lost her virginity that same night. She'd swept Ron Partridge over her threshold, initiating her own beloved tradition. She was nursing a hangover, giddily reliving the event. But around 8:30, she realized that her mother had not come down to breakfast. She checked her mother's bedroom, found it empty, took the bus down to the library, climbed the high stairs, knocked hard on the library doors, and heard a groan below. Laura lay under the William Penn Barberry bushes, below the yellow-trimmed windows of the nonfiction section. Her white stockings ran Jezebel red with blood. Sweat and melted snow had soaked her blouse, and her gray forehead blazed. The broken bones didn't kill Laura Merrick. She lay in the hospital, wheezing, her legs mortared up in casts. She had few visitors after the first week. Her church group was glad to fret over a poor thing for a day or two, but they trickled away when Laura had the bad manners to linger. On Valentine's Day, as her mother slept, Eliza drew big, sloppy hearts on her casts. Laura harumphed when she woke and insisted on keeping her legs hidden beneath blankets afterwards. But in late March, something miraculous happened. Laura's self-control dropped. She ranted at nurses, spit at doctors, swore like a Navy pilot dropping F-bombs on Hiroshima. She had dementia, the doctors said. Eliza decided that her mother had just stopped believing her own bullshit. The spells continued over the next 2 weeks, and Eliza enjoyed her mother's company for the first time. They swapped bawdy jokes, ogled the handsome interns, and chattered like best girlfriends late into the evening. They had long conversations, and Laura spoke her own mind in her own words about things that mattered to her. It broke Eliza's heart when the prim, condescending librarian returned. Laura hardly acknowledged anything that had passed between them. The clichés returned. You can't have your cake and eat it too. A leopard doesn't change its spots. Nothing is certain except death and taxes. This last proved true. On April 15th, Laura Merrick marked her Bible with a tongue depressor, set it on her nightstand, leaned back against the headboard, and coughed blood down the front of her nightdress. Eliza found her that way, dead as the proverbial doornail, and yes, the blood was thicker than water, just as her mother had always said. Much thicker than water, in fact. Perhaps as thick as molasses in January.